This is Eco Radio KC, a locally produced exploration of positive solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet.
Good evening, and thank you for tuning in to Eco Radio. On tonight's program, one of our hosts, Craig Lubo, will be speaking with Craig Volland from the Sierra Club about mercury pollution. Also, Dr. Portnoy from Children's Mercy Hospital will join us, and he will be talking about the health impacts of sulfur dioxide in the air. But first, I'm Natural Lee, and I have some of your environmental news. The United Kingdom's Conservative Coalition government has provided funding to a Scottish project to build the largest tidal array power generation facility in the world. The government has provided $17.8 million worth of grant funding to the Magan project, which will also receive funding support from the Scottish government and Britain's Crown Estate. Once the project is completed, it is expected to provide enough electricity for 175,000 homes and 100 ongoing jobs when completed. A government statement said the $90 million scheme could inspire further projects in the Pentland Firth, helping to provide clean, sustainable, and secure energy and jobs for the local community for decades to come. Tidal arrays extract energy from moving masses of water. The UK has around 50% of Europe's tidal energy resources, as Britain's geographic location means that it is easier to harness wave and tidal stream energy. The UK government estimated that it could meet 20% of the UK's electricity demand. Renewable energy generation is expected to play a major role in replacing one-fifth of the UK's aging coal and gas-fired power plants, which are due to be brought offline by 2020. The severe drought gripping the western United States in recent years is changing the landscape well beyond localized effects of water restrictions and browning lawns. Scientists at Scripps Institution of Oceanography at UC San Diego have now discovered that the growing, broad-scale loss of water is causing the entire western U.S. to rise up like an uncoiled spring. Investigating ground positioning data from GPS stations throughout the West, Scripps researchers Adrian Borsa, Duncan Agnew, and Dan Kavan found that the water shortage is causing what they're calling an uplift effect to 15 millimeters in California's mountains and, on average, 4 millimeters across the West. From the GPS data, they estimate that the water deficit at nearly 62 trillion gallons of water, equivalent to a six-inch layer of water spread out over the entire western U.S. Results of the study, which was supported by the U.S. Geological Survey, appear in the August 21st online edition of the journal Science. While pouring through various sets of data on ground positionings from highly precise GPS stations within the National Science Foundation's Plate Boundary Observatory and other networks, Borsa, a Scripps assistant research geophysicist, kept noticing the same pattern over the 2003 through 2014 period. All of the stations moved upwards in the most recent years, coinciding with the timing of the current drought. Agnew, a Scripps oceanography geophysics professor who specializes in studying earthquakes and their impact on shaping Earth's crust, says the GPS data can only be explained by rapid uplift of the tectonic plate upon which the western U.S. rests. Agnew cautions that the uplift has virtually no effect on the San Andreas Fault and therefore does not increase the risk of earthquakes. The grand opening of the Kansas City weapons plant took place on Friday, August 22nd. Over 50 people protested outside the entrance in what they called a dedication with regard to over 900 toxins left behind at the old plant. Henry Stover, Jim Hanna, and Mark Bartholomew were arrested in an act of civil disobedience. To hear what went on at the protest, tune in to KKFI's forum Wednesday at noon. And to hear what went on inside the plant at the grand opening, tune in to Tell Somebody Thursday at 9 a.m. Craig?
Thank you, Naturally. And today we have two guests. We have Craig Volland. He has a degree in civil engineering, and he is certified as a qualified environmental professional. And he is the chair of the Air Toxics Committee for the Sierra Club in Kansas. And he's going to be talking about mercury. And then we have Dr. Jay Portnoy, He is from Children's Mercy Hospital, and he is the medical director of the allergy and immunology and asthma division at the hospital. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Craig, let me start with, can you tell us what mercury is?
Well, mercury is a natural element that's found in the Earth's crust that, for the most part, had been sequestered or inaccessible to people for millions of years until we began to dig it up in one form or another. It is also present in the air in very tiny amounts, which is not particularly dangerous. But the reason it's becoming of more interest is because of methods that I will explain later. It is building up in our food chain, particularly our fish that we eat. And the crisis occurs because fish is considered a very healthy food, and hundreds of millions, even billions of people around the Earth depend on fish for their survival. So it's a growing issue, and there's been a recent international treaty about it. So that's why I'm here to talk about it.
Okay. Now, what is the difference between this natural form of mercury and methyl mercury?
Well, the natural form is called elemental mercury. It's that silver substance that until recently was in thermometers. I know when I was a kid, I played with it in school even, and nobody knew anything about it. I hate to tell you how long ago that was, but at any rate, it's not particularly dangerous unless you're exposed to it day in and day out in substantial concentrations. But what happens is this mercury gets into the air and floats around until it finally comes down either as dry deposition onto soil or is breathed in by plants which absorb it, or it comes down in rainfall. And when it gets into a water body, it goes to the bottom, or actually it can float around too, in anaerobic bacteria that thrive on the lack of oxygen, convert it to a form that is extremely poisonous. It's called methylmercury. The standard for the health standard where it has an impact for methylmercury, if you can believe this, is 0.2 of an ounce per day exposure is when it begins to impact the most sensitive receptor, which is the fetus in a female. So it is, in my experience, probably the most toxic poison that I know of.
And when you say toxic poison, is it to the extent that it would be fatal if you're exposed to that?
No. Well, in high enough concentrations, it has been fatal in a case in Japan, which really I call the Minamata incident in the late 50s, where it was extremely high concentrations in fish. But more commonly, the kind that we would encounter in fish we eat is it would act as a neurotoxin. And it basically, particularly in children or developing brains, causes mental retardation and decrements in memory, attention, language, and visual motor skills in childhood. So as adults, we are less susceptible to it than young children and the fetus particularly. The standards that the EPA has set is based on a harm to the fetus.
Okay. So they allow less because of the fetus than they would otherwise?
Right, because there's no way to control what people are doing out there. This has been around long enough when we didn't really know any better, that in the coastal areas, and a recent study showed in the coastal areas of the United States, between 8 and 16% of women have a body burden that's already above threshold of harm. And this threshold of harm, it does not, at one time we thought, had a large safety factor, but the very most recent and sensitive studies show that there's very little safety factor in this number. So 1 in 6 women in the coastal areas of the United States, if they get pregnant, are already in a position that their fetus may be harmed. In Korea, where they eat so much fish, it's 28% of the women. So it's already at the point of harm in many parts of the United States and the world.
And you've mentioned the toxicity when it gets into the fish. Is it also a problem? Does it get into other types of animals like beef and pork?
Not so much farm animals. Unfortunately, it does harm wildlife. I first got involved with the issue of mercury when I was helping citizens groups to fight big garbage incinerators that were proposed in the late 1980s. And I noticed that the equipment they were going to use did not remove mercury, so I started researching it. And I read about that the Swedes, which had relatively little industry, were finding all this mercury in their fish and their fish-eating birds and other mammals that eat fish. So I actually went to the first international conference on mercury as a global pollutant in Gavel, Switzerland, in the year 1990. And so they first discovered that it was a serious problem because it was affecting wildlife. And that's true everywhere. There are certain wildlife that, just like humans, if they eat fish all the time, their ability to reproduce is being impacted. So it affects any mammal that eats these fish, these contaminated fish.
Okay. And when I go into a grocery store, you'll see fish that they say is farm raised, and then you see fish that they say is wild caught. Is there a difference in terms of the levels of mercury that you're likely to see in the fish between those two groups?
Yes, but it's far more complicated that way. In general, the farmed fish will be lower in mercury. But unfortunately, there's other toxins that get into the feed that they give these farm fish. So that's not simple. But when you say wild caught, some of the highest levels of methylmercury are in wild caught fish that are high up in the food chain, like large tuna, sharks, swordfish. These kind of big predators that swim around the ocean have very high levels. So it's a real debate going on between those in the medical community who encourage particularly women to eat fish because it's good for the brain development, and those that say, well, if the pregnant women eat too much of this stuff, they'll get too much mercury, and they'll hurt the brain development. So there's a big debate going on right now. But it's very complicated in determining what fish is safe to eat and by whom. So there are some, you can go on the net and find a lot of information on that. For example, about the only commonly eaten fish that I think you're pretty much safe eating is wild-caught salmon. That's, in my experience and reading all of that, But there's other things, too. But you could eat tilapia, which is low. But tilapia also has very little omega-3 fatty acids, which is the good thing. So I really am not, I don't feel expert enough to, other than wild-caught salmon, to say a whole lot about it. And I encourage everybody to go to the Biodiversity Research Institute website, the Environmental Working Group website, and click on their studies on mercury in fish.
Okay. And where does the mercury come from for the most part?
Well, probably the largest source is from burning coal, and that's one of the connections I want to make tonight, is that's also the largest source of carbon dioxide that's causing climate change. And this is no accident because hundreds of millions of years ago, when the Earth was warmer, there was probably more mercury in the atmosphere, and it got absorbed by all the plants back during the Jurassic Age and so on, and when the world was full of swamps and prolific growth of plants. Well, all of those plants got buried over the subsequent hundreds of millions of years. And so what you ended up with was carbon contaminated with mercury. And coal has about 100 parts per billion of mercury in it for that reason, because way back when it was breathed in by the plants. Well, that's all well and good when it's buried. But what did we do, particularly 300 years ago, is start digging it up and burning it. So, in effect, the climate change problem is completely analogous to the mercury contamination problem. We essentially dug it back up and stuck it in the atmosphere so it could do harm. In the meantime, humans did not evolve defenses against methylmercury like some marine mammals do. For example, some whales or porpoises, seals have rather high levels of mercury in them, and it doesn't seem to hurt them. But that's because for millions of years they've been eating fish. But we haven't. So what we've done is essentially recreated this this problem for ourselves, just like we have with climate change.
So now you say that the seals have built up this resistance, but if a human eats the seal, then they're going to still get that mercury? Would that be correct?
Oh, yeah, exactly. And this is a real problem for the Inuit, for example, that depend on marine mammals for the bigger part of their diet. And so here we are in the industrial part of the world, have polluted it substantially, and now it's hurting the people that are really living closest to, you know, minimal sustainability.
And are there other sources besides the coal plants?
Yes, there's from metals processing. Actually, mercury has been used for processing gold ore all the way back to even before the Roman times. So a lot of mercury has been emitted as much as 2,000 years ago. But right now, one of the big sources, incidentally, cement making is a big source, because there's even tiny amounts in limestone that's a big used in cement making. But one of the biggest sources is what's called artisanal gold mining. This is in South America. You've probably read about or seen movies of these very poverty-stricken people digging up panning for gold, essentially. And they bring it up and they use mercury, which attaches very readily to gold, to actually separate the gold from the other medium that's in. And then in order to finally purify it, they burn off the mercury part of it. So here we are, 350 tons per year, metric tons per year, go into the air in the world from artisanal mining. And this is a really tough one to get at, because something like 100 million people are participating in this industry.
And are there things that the industry can be doing to reduce the amount of mercury put out into the air and water without necessarily stopping that activity?
Well, yes, but the best thing we can do, of course, if the same as for reducing greenhouse gases, is to quit burning coal in as far as possible. However, it is possible to remove mercury from the stacks of coal plants. And effective in 2016, all the coal plants in the United States will have to install what they call activated carbon injection. Because activated carbon absorbs the mercury as it comes out. So we find now Europe did this 20 years ago, because they realized that they really had a problem. All that mercury, like in Sweden, all that mercury was floating up from the industrial centers of Europe and getting into their water bodies. So they did something 20 years ago. We're just now getting around to it in 2016. There's also been some new regulation of cement kilns, except those that burn hazardous waste, which is a loophole, which is another story. But so, yeah, you can actually remove it from exhaust gases with carbon filters.
And once the, well, when you're cooking fish, is there a way, I guess, let me rephrase that, is there a way to get the mercury out of the fish through
no.
any process?
No, it's not like, say, beef where you could carve off the fat. It's pretty much in the muscle of the fish, that's the fillet that you're eating. There's not much you can do about it. I would say, personally, for those in Missouri and Kansas, I would right now tell you I would never eat any largemouth bass I caught in either state. Because recently, just in the last year, the Kansas Department of Health and Environment increased their health advisory on largemouth bass to, instead of eating it once a week, to not eating it more than once a month for sensitive populations. So I think you just have to be very careful about the fish you eat. And I urge people to go to these websites and learn about it. The other problem with about 90% of our exposure comes from commercial marine fish, most of which is imported, which means that a lot of it is mislabeled. So it's not, personally, I don't eat a lot of fish anymore, and I try to get omega-3 from ground flaxseed. But, you know, I'm not a pregnant female, so I really can't speak for them. So I do think they probably need to eat some fish, but they really need to educate themselves as to what kind of fish to eat.
When I asked that question before, too, what I was kind of thinking of, is the mercury absorbed by certain parts of the fish more than other parts of the fish, so that if you cut away those parts, for example, does the liver absorb more where you would cut away that part of the fish and then...
Oh, I don't think anybody eats fish liver that I know of, but no, you really can't. Once you got the fish fillets, which is mm-hmm. the form you're going to get it in, it's going to have pretty much evenly distributed mercury in it.
All right. And how many years, or is there a cycle, lifespan, where the mercury is no longer a problem?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, because 70% of the deposition of mercury in the earth comes from re-emissions. That once mercury is deposited to land or sea, under certain circumstances, it gets re-emitted in the air. That's why it's called a mercury cycle. And it's only when it's eventually covered up in sediment or covered up in drifting dust or whatever, soil, that it essentially gets sequestered out of the system. And the latest estimate is it's going to take 2,000 years for that to, if we quit emitting mercury today, industrial sources, it would take 2,000 years for it to all the reservoir to go out of the system. So that's why we have to act now and just be careful. And that's completely analogous to the carbon dioxide situation, that if we quit pumping all this greenhouse gases in, it's going to be at least hundreds of years before it gets back into equilibrium.
Okay. And while we talked about the health impacts, Dr. Portnoy, are you aware of any studies that have shown impacts with the neurotoxins that they would have on the immune system?
Mostly my understanding is that it has neurotoxic effects. I don't know of any significant impact on the immune system or on respiratory system.
And I believe we are ready for our first break, and we'll be back in a minute.
Hi, this is Richard Tripp with COP Incorporated, letting you know of a really easy way to help our brothers and sisters survive during this heat wave. It's called Luggage Jug. First, fill up a clean jug or plastic bottle with water, then freeze it overnight, and finally, take it with you as you go about your normal business. When you see a homeless person, let them have the jug. It's a simple way to help folks get through this extreme heat. This message is a public service announcement of 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
90.1 FM KKFI presents the 10th Annual Crossroads Music Fest, Saturday, September 6th at 6 p.m. 7 venues, 40 artists in downtown Kansas City. On a Broadway roastery stage in the Mercy Seat Alley, Chris Meck and the Guilty Birds, Hip Shot Killer, and Onward Crispin Glover perform for the first time in 10 years. That's the 10th Annual Crossroads Music Festival, Saturday, September 6th. Advance tickets, $15. CMFKC.com for information, or as always, go to KKFI.org for all of our events.
Okay, we are back, and I'm going to turn to and ask Dr. Portnoy to address some issues relating to sulfur dioxide and other air particulate matters. What are the different particulates that pose the most problems for people with asthma and allergies?
Well, I'm glad you asked that. Right now, the most important particulate to allergy sufferers is ragweed pollen, which started pollinating just a few weeks ago, and I've got the pollen count right now at 631, of which 427 grains per cubic meter is ragweed. It's a significant allergen, causes hay fever and asthma, and lots of trouble for people at this time of year. It's likely to peak around September 10th and will last through October. So right now, the biggest problem particulate in the air is a biologic, which is ragweed derived from plants. Ragweed's season ragweed is just one of the components of the air. Thing that it triggers is asthma, which is the concern that I have. I'm an allergist. Asthma is a respiratory disease that causes children and adults to have coughing, wheezing, and labored breathing. It affects 83,000 adults and 31,000 children in the Kansas City area. So it's a significant problem. I also, as I just pointed out during the break, Mid-America Regional Council has announced a red alert day for ozone. Ozone is another one of the pollutants that's in the atmosphere. Ozone is instead of O2 or oxygen, it's a O3, a more oxygenated form of oxygen. It's highly water soluble. When somebody inhales or breathes ozone into your respiratory tract, it dissolves in the mucous membranes, causing oxidation and irritation. So people tomorrow who are exposed to this ozone are likely to develop itchy, watery eyes, kind of a burning sensation in your nose. And if you have asthma, it might trigger asthma. So it's recommended that people who have respiratory problems try to stay indoors, limit your outdoor activity. If you do need to do things outdoors, try to do it in the early morning or the late evening. The reason for that time shift is because ozone is created by the combination of particulates that are in the air along with sunlight as they interact with hydrocarbons such as gasoline. So it sort of acts as a catalyst. This photoreactive effect actually triggers gasoline, turns it into ozone, which then pollutes the air. So when the sun is shining, the air is hot and still, like it will be tomorrow, that's when ozone is going to be a problem.
And is that why I think I've seen in the past where they've recommended that when you're getting gas filling up your car that you do it at night?
Right. If you fill your gas tank during the daytime, some of the gas leaks out. It doesn't all go into the tank because it vaporizes. It's very volatile. And so as a result, it's recommended you do it at nighttime. The same gas escapes, which is unfortunate, but at least the sun is not shining on it, causing this photo effect that catalyzes a conversion into ozone. And so that's the reason for that. They also recommend not mowing your lawn during the daytime, because that produces a lot of pollutants also.
Okay. And what about sulfur dioxide?
Well, here we go. So, as we heard, mercury is a trace component of coal. Sulfur is also a trace component. Coal is not pure carbon. It's got other trace things. When we burn coal, what we're doing is we're oxidizing it, turning it into carbon dioxide. At the same time, we're also turning sulfur into sulfur dioxide. Sulfur dioxide, the main source in the atmosphere, in fact, is coal. There are very few other natural sources of sulfur dioxide. Sulfur dioxide, when it dissolves in water, turns into sulfurous acid. So imagine having acid in your mucous membranes because that's where it dissolves. Sulfur dioxide is not as water-soluble as ozone, so it tends to penetrate more deeply into the lungs before it dissolves and causes an irritation and an inflammatory response. So as a result, it's more harmful to people with asthma. It's more likely to cause asthma episodes.
Now, when we talk about asthma, too, I want to be clear. Are we talking about primarily the bronchial tubes, or are we talking about mostly lung issues, or both?
Well, it's the same thing. Basically, the lungs are the organ in your body that exchange air, increases intakes oxygen and exhales carbon dioxide. So it's the air exchange organ of your body. The tubes that lead from your nose and your mouth down into your lungs are called the bronchi. Bronchi are just air passages that go down into the lungs, leading to the alveoli where the air exchange actually takes place. The bronchi transmit air in and out, and irritating things that get into the bronchi can cause inflammation. Sort of think like when you had a bad cold and your nose swelled up and there was a lot of mucus, you couldn't breathe through your nose. The same things happen in your airways where they swell up and produce mucus also. The problem is there's no mouth to open like you would with a cold when you're having trouble breathing through your lungs. You're trying to breathe through these narrow, swollen air passages, and in many cases, it's really hard for the air to go in and out. So that is why people develop a severe cough. They're trying to clear the mucus. You might start wheezing, and eventually you have trouble breathing.
And is sulfur dioxide, is that affected by the heat as well, like ozone, or is that independent to temperature?
Not as much. It's more independent. It's not like ozone that's produced by a photochemical reaction. The sulfur dioxide is produced by burning coal. And so, you know, basically when we burn coal to fire our coal-fired power plants and make electricity, we're also causing this pollutant to get into the air and trigger asthma episodes. And we are seeing a substantial number of asthma episodes. Just recently, hospital has been full of asthma. We've had lots and lots of children going to the emergency room, being admitted to the hospital. It's become a big problem at this time of year.
And I understand that Kansas City is out of attainment with the EPA standards for that.
Right.
What are the EPA standards? And are they adequate, or are they set too high to be
I
safe?
Believe for sulfur dioxide, it's 71 parts per million, which is a level that in many cases the sulfur dioxide levels are below that, but periodically they rise above that. And if you look at the numbers, you can actually see the hour-by-hour sulfur dioxide levels. It's on the EPA website. It goes up and down with the day and night. So it's higher during the daytime. It's lower than during the nighttime, which suggests that there might be a photochemical reaction. But in fact, what's happening is more coal is burned during the daytime because we're using more electricity. At nighttime, when electricity use goes down, less coal is burned and the sulfur dioxide levels tend to drop because it is water-soluble, so it goes away during the nighttime. What's interesting is that on weekends, sulfur dioxide levels remain relatively low because electricity use is much lower at that time.
And you mentioned it's water-soluble.
Yes.
So does that get into
water?
Contaminate the water? Is that a separate health issue then?
It's another health issue that, you know, there's always one effect and then it leads to another and then to another. So there's always unintended consequences. Sulfur dioxide is very water soluble. What the scrubbers do on coal-fired power plants is they actually spray water across the fumes that are going out, and the water dissolves in, or the sulfur dioxide dissolves in that water, and so then the water is collected and it contains the sulfur dioxide in the form of sulfurous acid. In the past, much of that was allowed to run off into the rivers, and so we were taking it out of the air and putting it in the water, which is probably not a good thing either. The sulfur dioxide that wasn't scrubbed out would get into the atmosphere, can travel long distances, and if you remember in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, there was a condition called acid rain. It was caused by power plants in the Midwest producing coal-fired power plant emanations. They actually had very, very tall power stacks in order to get the pollution to go away from urban areas. What that would do is cause the gases to travel long distances, and then the rain would cause it to wash out in the forest in the northeast. And that caused a lot of damage to the forest. That's what we call acid rain.
Okay. And in fact, I think when we were at the sulfur dioxide forum that was held over here in Kansas, Missouri, there were two monitoring sites, one over in Missouri, one in Kansas.
Right.
And from the way it looked at the map, it looks like most of it would be coming from the Kansas side. Is that fair to say, or?
You know, personally, I think if you're going to monitor a gas like sulfur dioxide, it walks around, it's heterogeneous, it doesn't form a uniform plume. It comes from focal sources. It seems to me that two monitoring stations in a metropolitan area just probably isn't adequate. I think that you'd get a more accurate representation of what the sulfur dioxide levels actually are by having multiple monitoring stations throughout the community. If we're going to set standards and try to attain them, I think we need better monitoring so we know what we're really doing. Otherwise, if you put a station right downwind from a coal power plant, you're going to get very high levels. It might not be so high if you just put it a mile or two to the side.
Yeah. And when we were talking about the effects and the impact on asthma in terms of both sulfur as well as the other contaminants.
Right.
At least with the sulfur, when it's higher like this and when we're out of attainment, have they been able to confirm that there is, in fact, an increase in hospital admissions when that occurs?
It's really hard to say. You can do statistics and look at the number of hospital admissions, and we know this year that hospital admissions have been higher than they were before, but can we say that that's because of a specific level of sulfur dioxide, or are there other factors that might be playing a role? There's so many different variables, it's hard to say that one admission is caused by one coal plant, for example. It would be really hard to say that. It's sort of like, why is today really hot? Is that a manifestation of climate change? Well, I can't say that because there's a lot of variability in the system. And so what we have to do is look at the statistics over time. We do know that over time, the number of people with asthma has been increasing. We know that the number of hospitalizations and emergency department visits continues to rise, even though we have better medicines and better ways of managing patients who have asthma. But at the same time, there are so many other things that have taken place: climate change, SO2, carbon sulfur dioxide, ozone. There's also nitrogen dioxide, which is another product of combustion, although we don't have so much of that in the Kansas City area. And then there's also indoor allergens. There's lifestyle changes. People are, you know, heavier than they were. They don't get as much exercise. We tend to spend a lot more time indoors where we have indoor pollutants, which we haven't even talked about. So many variables. It's just hard to say that one thing is causing the other thing. All we can say is that there is an increased risk of having problems when these things are higher, such as air pollution.
Okay. When you, I don't know if you've seen any studies, but let's say that compare other countries, and when you're dealing with other regions of the world where they have better controls on this stuff, does it appear that there generally a lower rate of respiratory problems in those countries?
Clearly, countries that have cleaner air have fewer respiratory problems. Countries with worse air have more respiratory problems. We'll look at Beijing in China. Their air quality is probably some of the worst air on the planet. They get a lot of particulates from the Gobi Desert they blow in, a lot of cars producing petrochemicals, which convert into ozone, nitrogen oxides, and so on, and their asthma rates are very high. Whereas in countries that have very clean air, particularly places in the mountains like Switzerland, for example, with very low rates of problems. Is that because of the air quality, or are there other things? I mean, climbing mountains in Switzerland probably is good for your health anyway, so who knows? But there is that correlation, and you can sort of, you know, try to infer something from that, but it's hard to say cause and effect.
Okay. And if somebody is having problems with asthma, What do you tell them to do to help reduce that in terms of their exposure to outdoor contaminants?
Right. So the first thing is to make the diagnosis. If somebody has asthma, it's important that they know that they have asthma. A lot of times people who cough a lot and wheeze and have trouble breathing, they're diagnosed with pneumonia, they're diagnosed with emphysema, which they might very well have if they've been smoking cigarettes. There are many other diseases that they might be diagnosed with, but in fact, in many cases, they have asthma. So you need to get an accurate diagnosis. Once you have asthma, it's important to identify what the triggers are. In many cases, if you have allergies, it might be indoor triggers, dust mites, molds, furry animals, rodents, cockroaches. Things like that can really be significant triggers of asthma. Because I treat asthma and we have an allergy department at Children's Mercy Hospital, we have an environmental assessment program too. So we have a team of people who can actually go out to homes and try to identify what the triggers are in the home that make the asthma hard to control or persistent. It's a very successful program, and if people are interested, they can contact the hospital and try to find out more about it. If you think you have something in your home that might be triggering your asthma, we can oftentimes find out what that is. Avoiding indoor exposures is great, but outdoor exposures can be a problem too. The problem is if you don't get rid of the indoor exposures and you go inside to escape the outdoor exposures, you're just going into the indoor exposure, so it doesn't help. So you really have to make sure that both locations are as clean as they can be. Bad days, ozone, sulfur dioxide, the housing envelope really does protect you from infiltration into the indoor environment. So you can escape into your house as long as the house is less polluted than the outside.
So the air conditioning systems aren't drawing
right
contaminants inside?
Not really. There's more circulation than ventilation. The ventilation that does go in, the ozone and other particles tend to chemically react with the building materials before they enter into the airspace of the occupants of the house. So as a result, indoor air quality tends to be better than outdoor air quality unless there are sources of contamination inside the house.
Okay. And you mentioned nitrogen oxide,
right?
And you said that's from combustion. So is that something that you get from burning coal too, then?
Not as much. It's more automobiles. When you have combustion that occurs at high temperature, remember the atmosphere is mostly made out of nitrogen. And so at high temperature, nitrogen will combine with oxygen to form NOxes. There are different levels of oxidation of the nitrogen. So it's really just a function of high temperatures and combustion that cause the nitrogen and oxygen to form together. They don't like to stay together too long, so when you inhale them, they dissolve in mucous membranes and then break apart and oxidize the lining of your membranes and cause the same inflammation that the other contaminants would cause. Nitroxides tend to be more prominent the more cars you have. It seems to be really a car-driven type of thing. So cities like Los Angeles would just have tremendous amounts of nitroxides. In the Kansas City area, it's not as much of a problem. We just don't have the density that they do in some of the big urban centers.
Okay. And in terms of the impact when it causes the inflammation and the respiratory problems, does that tend to be short-term and temporary so that if you remove the... If we get rid of sulfur dioxide and all these other contaminants, would those people with their health tend to return to normal, or does this result in permanent damage?
The bubble question, if I could live in a clean bubble with no contaminants, would I get better? And the fact is, yes, in fact. We recommend that people avoid exposure to things that trigger their asthma, and when they do that, their asthma really does get better. There are some individuals who have experienced permanent lung damage. It's impossible to predict who those people are likely to be. But in most cases, people who have asthma, especially children, do completely recover once they're not exposed to the harmful things in the environment.
Okay. And let me go back, Craig.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
You noticed that tomorrow we have a red alert, which is going to be essentially a spike in ozone. When you have asthma, does this have the capability of almost instantaneously causing an attack, or do we need one or two exceedances in a row, like several days, for the tendency to build up? Just how instantaneous is this risk?
Well, it's kind of like you said, that one instance of mercury where you just had a massive exposure and that was highly toxic. It really depends on how much ozone you're exposed to. If I take an asthmatic person and expose them to really, really high levels of ozone, I can trigger an asthma attack right away. The kind of ozone that we're experiencing in the atmosphere would probably require a number of days of exposure, leading to slowly increasing amounts of inflammation. Keep in mind, if somebody starts out already inflamed, let's say they might have had a respiratory infection just recently, and they're exposed to ragweed pollen now, which is triggering their asthma, and you add to that the ozone, then it might cause a problem more quickly than if they didn't have those other exposures. So there is an additive effect.
Okay, great, thanks.
Yeah, I understand, too, that in terms of sulfur dioxide, that diesel engines, diesel fuel is also a major source of that.
Well, diesel is actually a combustion product of burning diesel fuel. It forms these little teeny particles. That's very scientific, little teeny particles between 2 and 5 microns in size. We do the daily pollen and mold count. That's what I was referring to earlier. And on the slide, we can also see diesel particles. In many cases, they outnumber the pollen particles in the air. This is carbon, and when a pollen like ragweed the allergen gets onto the carbon, it forms an adjuvant, which when it gets into the lower airways actually makes the pollen more potent. So the combination of ragweed plus diesel tends to make pollen more allergenic and can cause more health problems. So that's how diesel can indirectly cause health problems. The ultra-small particulates, those particles that are less than 1 micron in size, can actually get down to the alveoli and travel into the bloodstream, and you can detect blood circulating particles that can cause cardiovascular diseases, plaque, arteriosclerosis, and things like that. So, we're just now learning about all of the health effects that these particles can have on human beings. And I think that the more we learn, the more we really want to strive to have cleaner air.
Okay. And let me ask you, Craig, in terms of regulations on this, both in terms of sulfur dioxide as well as mercury, what is being done by the government to regulate that?
Well, the EPA installed new hourly standards for sulfur dioxide in 2010, and it always takes a couple of years for anything to happen. So that's actually a short-term standard of an hourly standard. I think it was, I forget what it was, I think it was 24 hours before. So they're actually taking action on sulfur dioxide. They're also requiring tighter standards for emissions from coal plants, and this has to do with long-range transport to cities in the East Coast, for example. So they're taking action there. As far as mercury is concerned, they are planning to require all coal plants by 2016 to have mercury removal. So they're making some progress on both of those.
Okay.
The problem with mercury is really the what we call the legacy reservoir. It's all the, for example, the largest amount of current pollution is India and China. But before we jump on them, we've got to remember the biggest chunk of that legacy reservoir that's been around for 100 years came from us in our industrial revolution, and also all the gold and silver mining we did. So we're all responsible.
And just hypothetically, I know we're not likely to achieve that, but if we eliminated all sources of mercury, is there projections to how long it might take for it to be cleaned out of the atmosphere where the fish would not be contaminated?
Yeah, 2,000 years.
2,000. Okay. All right. And I want to thank both of you for being here. That's all the time we have. And naturally, we'll have our calendar next. After a few messages.
Hi, I'm Lyanda Lynn Haupt, author of Crow Planet, Essential Wisdom from the Urban Wilderness. Next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about how crows deepen our connection to the wild, natural world.
New Dimensions airs at 5 a.m. on Tuesdays. This week on The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature.
The transition to a world powered by 100% clean energy is inevitable. The question is, who's going to control the clean energy infrastructure that we're building out?
I'm Neil Harvey. This week it's 100% renewables on The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature.
Friday morning at 9:30.
I have your events. Again, this is Naturally. And mercury pollution, a global environmental crisis. Tuesday, September 9th at 6:30 p.m., one of our guests here, Craig Vollen, the chair of the Sierra Club's Air Quality Committee, will be making this presentation at Overland Park Lutheran Church on 79th Street. And this is, again, September 9th, 2014, at 6:30 p.m. Of the 25 largest mercury-polluting coal plants, the second is in Missouri. Craig's knowledge of mercury contamination began with his attending the first international conference on mercury as a pollutant in 1990 in Sweden. The Wild and Scenic Film Festival, one of the largest environmental film festivals in North America, is coming to Kansas City at the Burns and McDonald Auditorium on the evening of September 6, 2014. The USGBC Central Plains chapter would like to invite you to view an amazing series of films with themes relating to the natural environment. The Wild and Scenic Film Festival works with environmentally conscious groups across the country to host tour venues as a way to outreach into their communities and bring together a diverse audience. So they hope to use this festival to increase a better community understanding of the connection we share with the planet and our roles as stewards to keep it healthy for future generations. Again, this takes place on Saturday, September 6th from 6 to 9 at the Burns and McDonald Auditorium at 94th and Ward Parkway. Costs $12 a person, and you can find out more about this on our Facebook page. And on September 30th, the Kansa Group will be screening The Vanishing of Bees in conjunction with Johnson County Community College's Harvest Week celebration. This is at 6:30 p.m. at JCCC Building GEB Room 233. The admission does not cost, and this is Tuesday, September 30th. A panel of local experts will lead a discussion and answer questions after the movie. The risks to critical pollinators may herald the next silent spring. Now is the time to act, learn how, and come out for a night of fun, friends, and a great film. And on Thursday, August 28th, at 6:30 p.m. at the Plaza Branch Library, forests produce lumber, shelter a dazzling variety of plant and animal life, and serve as our planet's lungs, cleansing the atmosphere of carbon dioxide. But we're losing them at an alarming rate. The Smithsonian Institution's Stuart Davies addresses their importance to the overall health of our planet in the third installment of Conserving Our Dynamic Planet, a series featuring talks by the Smithsonian scientists and co-presented by the Linda Hall Library. Davies, a tropical ecologist with 22 years of experience working throughout the tropics, is director of the Smithsonian Center for Tropical Forest Science. You can find these events posted on our Eco Radio KC Facebook page, and we also like to invite you to like that page while you are there. Thank you for tuning in.
Thank you very much for that. I just want to add a couple of things, environmental programs on KKFI that haven't already been mentioned during this program. On Thursday, we've got a few. So at noon on Thursday on Sprouts, a Navajo elder remembered. We rebroadcast the show about Leonard Benally, Navajo elder from Big Mountain, Arizona. He lived his life in resistance to the government's repeated attempts to displace him and his people from Big Mountain, a coal-rich region highly desired by mining interests like Peabody Coal. Then immediately following at 12:30 on Thursday, pesticides on the playground. How safe your children are might depend on where you live. That's 12:30 on Making Contact. And then at 7 o'clock that night, after the Heartland Labor Forum, on the Thursday night special, The Business with Bees, a documentary that explores the causes behind honeybee population declines, featuring discussions with beekeepers and scientists. We're going to go now to Green News Report. Thank you for listening to Eco Radio KC.
It's Thursday, August 21, 2014.
5 inches of rain fell in some areas. Almost as much rain in a few hours as parts of the state get in an entire year.
Way too much water now falling on the Arizona desert.
8,000 gallons of fuel, we're told, is involved in this spill.
Another day, another toxic spill.
This is really is going to enable a new era in photovoltaics research.
Recycling old car batteries into solar panels. Wind energy prices hit an all-time low, plus...
It looks sort of like a cross between a spaceship and a covered wagon and old mill.
An innovative water wheel automagically cleans up Baltimore Harbor.
All of that and more straight ahead from BradBlog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
There's that Gallup poll that came out last month which found 1 in 4 Americans is skeptical of all the effects of climate change.
Who gives a shit? You don't need people's opinions on a fact. You might as well have a poll asking which number is bigger, 15 or 5.
Well, it depends which news channel you're asking. This is your Green News Report.
Or do owls exist? Or are there hats?
Okay, Desi Doyen, we spent some time in Phoenix, Arizona this summer. I thought we were just lucky we got caught in 2 haboobs, dust storms, and 1 huge downpour that I spoke to local residents there who said they had never seen anything like it in all of their years out there. But we weren't just lucky. The extreme weather in the southwestern desert continues.
Yeah, it's actually gotten even worse. Dramatic rescues were caught on camera from flash flooding in Phoenix this week.
Way too much water, a torrent of rain falling too quickly in that desert state. That has triggered flash floods and high water rescues from people trapped in their homes and cars.
5 inches of rain fell in some areas. Almost as much rain in a few hours as parts of the state get in an entire year.
Flash floods knocked out power and actually ripped off parts of homes. It's funny that we had to travel to the desert of Arizona to see rain since we've seen so little of it in California.
We've seen none of it in California.
Heavy deluges are blamed for a rash of deadly landslides around the world this week. 8 inches of rain fell on the city of Hiroshima, Japan. 8 inches in just 3 hours caused the landslide that killed at least 27 people. Record storms also caused deadly flash floods in Sweden, Thailand, Nepal, and India this week. Global warming is linked to the observed increase in heavy deluges.
Just to underscore that, this is not just extreme weather. It seems to be a broken climate. Pay attention.
Another day, another toxic spill.
This is the Duke Energy plant that we're talking about. Just after midnight, they had a fuel spill. 8,000 gallons of fuel, we're told, is involved.
Just 5 months after Duke Energy's massive coal ash spill in the Dan River in North Carolina, Duke Energy is now taking responsibility for another spill, this time on the Ohio River near Cincinnati this week, the source of drinking water for millions. The Coast Guard has shut down 15 miles of the Ohio River to prevent that diesel fuel from entering Cincinnati's water supply. Heavy rains are also blamed for the collapse of another huge mining waste tailings pond, this time just south of the U.S. border in Mexico this week, that spilled 10 million gallons of acids and heavy metals into 2 rivers downstream. Mexican officials say the mine company neglected to report the acid spill until residents called in to report their rivers were turning orange. How about some good news, some breakthroughs and innovations?
How about something, anything?
Well, John Kellett of the Baltimore Maritime Museum was so disgusted by the trash in Baltimore's Inner Harbor, he invented a solar-powered water wheel to clean it up using the water's own current.
It's being turned by the current of the Jones Falls, which is flowing very rapidly because we just had pretty large rainstorm. And that wheel is turning this conveyor belt that is picking up all of this trash that is flowing down the Jones Falls. We've got a lot of plastic bottles, we've got a lot of styrofoam cups, and I believe the water wheel has just accumulated its first tire.
In the 3 months since it's been in Baltimore Harbor, the water wheel has already picked up 40 tons of trash.
Where would that trash have ended up otherwise?
Out in the harbor.
Out in these garbage gyres that we hear about around the world?
Yes.
Well, thank you, Mr. Kellett.
Researchers at MIT have developed a breakthrough method to recycle the toxic lead from old car batteries to make cheap solar panels made with a substance called perovskite.
And this has really been a paradigm shift because these materials are extremely inexpensive, and they promise to reach the highest efficiencies.
Finally, in Britain, bad weather is a boost for wind energy. Instead of being battered by recent storms, Britain's onshore wind farms instead harvested that energy, generating a record 22% of the UK's electricity, more than double the amount that was provided by coal on the same day. And in the U.S., wind energy prices have hit an all-time low. In some parts of the country, wind energy is now the cheapest source of electricity utilities can buy, cheaper even then subsidized coal.
Well, it must be lemons into lemonade week. Well done, Desi Doyen. For much more on all of those stories, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
To admit, it's getting better.
Thanks for listening to Eco Radio KC on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.